Are you addicted to sex? Do you know someone who has too much sex? Can you have so much sex that suddenly a switch flips in your brain and suddenly you can't stop? What does sex addiction mean? We'll answer these questions and more with clinical psychologist Dr. David Lay, who treats perpetrators and victims of sexual abuse and has expanded his practice to include the full range of sexualities. This is a conversation about sex addiction on Sexploration with Monica.
This is sex. Everyone gets what they want. This is Sexploration.
Explore. Play.
This is Sexploration with Monica. Sex is proof that God loves us and wants us to have fun.
Sexploration with Monica.
At sexplorationwithmonica.com. Is it an addiction? Is it just bad choices? This has legal ramifications, and it also has some pretty interesting implications on how we think about cheating, for example, or sex crimes. Dr. David Lay is a clinical psychologist practicing in New Mexico. He first began his practice treating perpetrators and victims of sexual abuse and has expanded his practice to include the promotion of healthy sexuality and awareness of the wide range of normative sexual behaviors. We're going to be talking with him about sex addiction today, and he's written a book, The Myth of Sex Addiction. So you believe, Dr. Lay, that sex isn't an addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a long history of people calling sex a disease. I mean, you know, a couple hundred years ago, women who liked sex too much were nymphomaniacs. Mm-hmm. Now, men who like sex too much are sex addicts. And really, this is just another form of people who are afraid of sex trying to control it and trying to prevent other people from having too much of it. To be honest, I'm not sure I want anybody in my bedroom telling me whether they like the sex I'm having or not, or whether I'm having too much.
So you think that because it's so subjective, like some people think a lot of sex is having sex once a day with your partner, and other people say lots of sex is having, you know, sex every day with a different sex worker. Because it's so subjective, you think that we should have different criteria for measuring what is healthy and unhealthy.
It is incredibly subjective. You know, Alfred Kinsey, the researcher, said that the definition of a nymphomaniac is somebody who has sex more than the therapist. That's what we have here. And even though people will argue that the criteria includes an element of what they call distress or dysfunction, in other words, they're saying, well, it's not just that you're having too much sex, but you're having too much sex and it's causing problems in your life. They like to say that, but the reality is they don't apply it. And in my book, I give lots and lots of examples of places where they are making the determination that sex is unhealthy or addictive, not because there are problems, but merely because they don't like the kind of sex you're having. It is incredibly subjective, and the example you gave actually is a pretty good one, because I've had people come in and tell me that they think that they are a sex addict, that they feel like their sexuality is just out of control. They feel like they're unable to stop themselves from masturbating or having sexual thoughts. And this one person that I'm thinking of was a young man who grew up in a very religious household. He was masturbating about once a week, and he believed that that was out of control, and he came in saying, I think I'm a sex addict.
Oh.
Clearly he wasn't, and clearly that kind of sex was not causing problems in his life. The problem was in the conflict between his moral beliefs and the beliefs that he had been told about what kind of sexuality is appropriate and healthy versus his libido and his desire to have sex. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that moral beliefs and attitudes towards sex are that there's anything wrong with them. I think that there are. I think we have a lot of appropriate moral and religious beliefs about sex that are important for people and important for families, important for society. But they're not medicine. We shouldn't be basing diagnoses and treatment and research on those moral values.
Because there are some people who are making unhealthy choices in their sex life, choices that damage both themselves and their partners.
Sure. There are people that make unhealthy choices about everything in their life. One of the ones I'm particularly fond of these days is the degree to which people are making unhealthy choices in their life related to Facebook. I've seen marriages that have fallen apart over Facebook.
Crackbook.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you know, in my BlackBerry a couple of years ago, people were calling it Crackberry.
Right.
Because it's hard to put the damn thing down. But it's non-addictive. It's not an addiction. It's not a disease. It's not out of our control. Sex is no more or less important than any of these other behaviors.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what addiction is and what it means. What is the definition of addiction in the psychological context?
Well, this is one of the places where it gets pretty muddy. And you have to understand that addiction right now, the word addiction, does not actually appear in what's called the DSM. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. It's basically the Bible that lists out different kinds of mental disorders. The DSM currently talks about what's called substance abuse and substance dependence. The word addiction is, unfortunately, in our society, very broadly used at this point, and it is used to describe people who do things repetitively, even though it is causing problems in their life and they don't feel like they can stop. But unfortunately, we are now applying the word addiction to things like chapstick, things like tanning beds, things like Facebook, and the word addiction has stopped to mean something that is very valuable. One of the good examples that I give in my book, actually at the end of the book, at the end of Myth of Sex Addiction, I talk about Harry Potter, and I was working with this young 9 or 10-year-old little girl who came in and she said, "I think I'm addicted to Harry Potter." And I almost laughed my head off. But
oh, yeah, I know how she feels, though.
Yeah. Well, she was getting in trouble because she couldn't stop reading Harry Potter and she couldn't stop listening to the Harry Potter tapes, and she was getting in trouble because she was doing that stuff when she wasn't supposed to.
Mm.
The reality is, for that little girl, Harry Potter was a friend. It was an escape. She was kind of lonely. She didn't have some friends around, and so it was a way for her to feel nurtured and not alone, kind of enjoy herself. And I worked with her. I worked with her to help find different things to do, worked with her parents on different things that she could do instead of the Harry Potter, find different ways to engage with it. And the problem went away. Now, interestingly enough, there's actually research by a psychologist where he showed that when the last Harry Potter book came out, certain Harry Potter fans actually went through what they called withdrawal syndrome.
Oh, totally.
Where they were cranky and obnoxious.
Oh, I was so sad.
Because they didn't have it to read anymore.
It was awful. Yeah.
But it didn't last. And this little girl, you know, after she made some changes in her life, I came back and I asked her, you know, "Do you think you were addicted?" And she said, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, why?" She said, "Because it was hard to stop." But she did. And that's unfortunately the thing that we're doing now, is that we are pretending that just because something is hard to stop doing, that it's addictive and that it is a disease. But I think that's a dangerous message, because what we're doing is we're telling people that when something is really hard to stop doing, it means you're powerless over it.
Mm.
Sex is not like that. If we tell people that they're powerless over their sexual desires, we're creating a very dangerous message. And I'm concerned that potentially we're even telling people, well, just because you were aroused, it's not your fault that you committed that sex crime, because you're addicted to sex. And in fact, that's one of the tragedies that I've seen that I talk about in the sex addiction, is that sex addiction is used extensively in court by people trying to avoid consequences for their behaviors, whether it is cheating and being divorced, or whether it is committing sex crimes like rape and child sex abuse. People are going in and saying, "Well, it's not my fault, I'm a sex addict." But it's not a real disease, it's not an accepted diagnosis, and it doesn't meet criteria for acceptable evidence in a court of law. But people are using it as a get-out-of-jail-card-free.
Right. So not only is it disempowering because we believe that sex, we are powerless over our impulses, but also it's allowing people to get away with making hurtful choices and hurting other people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the fascinating things, and you know, as my book has gotten out there and I'm getting, you know, emails and contacts from people, I've heard from both men and women who've been damaged by the label of sex addiction. One man wrote me the other day, and he talked about the fact that he and his wife dragged him to a therapist, and the therapist called him a sex addict because the guy liked to look at porn every now and then, about once a week, and his wife just really didn't like it and thought that porn was just absolutely unacceptable. The wife and the therapist called him a sex addict. Another woman wrote me, and she said that, you know, her husband went to told her that she couldn't divorce him because her husband was a sex addict. It wasn't his fault that he was cheating, and that if she did divorce him, her husband would probably kill himself.
Did he say that he was going to kill himself?
Not helpful.
Right.
And in fact, it's dangerous, and I see it doing lots of harm. One of the big kind of places that I see as dangerous is the way in which this label is applied to male sexuality. 85% to 90% of the people diagnosed as sex addicts are men, and the majority of the behaviors that are called sexually addictive are male sexual behaviors. These include things like masturbation, use of pornography, going to strip clubs, infidelity, use of prostitutes. These are all behaviors that are overwhelmingly predominantly masculine. And so what we're doing is we're turning male sexuality into a disease.
Well, I would hate to say that any of those things are excluded from women being able to choose to do them in a healthy or unhealthy way, of course, but it truly is less predominant among women, yes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, women don't go to prostitutes. You know, and if you think about it,
sometimes they do, not too frequently. I mean, I talk to sex workers who see women. Of course, most of their clients are men, but I do know some sex workers who have female clients. It's rare. You're right.
It is rare because women may not have to go to prostitutes, or when women do, they keep it much quieter. Whereas roughly 16% of American men will, on average, go to a prostitute at least once in their life. Regardless of whether they go, nearly half of all American men believe prostitution is acceptable. The numbers are far smaller for women. But what we're doing when we apply the label of sex addict to men is that we're saying unless a man engages in normal, acceptable kinds of sexual behavior that don't include masturbation, that don't include pornography, don't include strippers, don't include cheating, that they are unhealthy. But the reality is that, you know, throughout history, men have engaged in those behaviors. You know, David and Solomon in the Bible had hundreds of thousands of wives. And even David in the Bible, the hundreds of wives he had wasn't enough, and he still wanted somebody else's wife.
Well, I think that there's the ability we have now to make distinctions like healthy, which behaviors are consensual, which behaviors are having a good impact on yourself and the people in your life, so that I think it's actually important to make a distinction between porn and, for instance, cheating. Of course, that's my opinion.
I agree. I think that, unfortunately, the challenge is who gets to decide what's healthy and who gets to decide what's appropriate. And so right now what we have is if somebody else doesn't like your sexual behavior, then it gets called addictive. It gets called unhealthy. One of the number one reasons why men enter sex addiction treatment is because they want sex more than their wife does. And whenever anybody in a couple wants sex more than the other one does, they almost invariably end up getting called a sex addict. That's a matter of libido. It's a relationship issue. It's not a disease.
Can we talk a little bit about the kinds of addiction that do end up being more like disease, like alcohol and drug addiction, and the difference between what people are calling sex addiction and then alcohol addiction, for example?
The number one difference is that, you know, with alcohol, with drugs, these are ingesting different substances into the body and into the brain that actually change the way the brain or the body is working. When somebody consumes alcohol, it is affecting their entire body. When somebody is aroused, they may be very aroused, but their brain is still working the way it is supposed to. There are no neurochemicals in the brain that aren't supposed to be there. There are no chemicals in the body that aren't supposed to be there.
So dopamine and oxytocin.
Nobody died from wanting to have sex and not getting to have it.
But people do die.
If you take a hardcore alcoholic and take away alcohol, make them go cold turkey, they can actually die because their body has become physiologically dependent upon the presence of that substance.
Right. Now, what are the dangers to society in believing that there is such a thing as a diagnosis of sex addiction?
It's a good question. I think actually there are several. Now, one of the things I have to kind of say is when I went into writing this book, I really had to ask myself, you know, is this important? Does it really matter if people are out there getting help, you know, by calling themselves sex addicts? Does it matter? Ultimately, I decided that it does matter, and here are some of the reasons why. One is that I think that this is a way for a certain moral and morally motivated group to put restrictions on the other people's sexuality. Now, a great example crossed my desk the other day. I wish this had come out before I wrote the book. There's a religious group out there who is attacking Planned Parenthood and saying that Planned Parenthood is teaching kids to be sex addicts, and that by promoting sexually appropriate behaviors like kissing, that is encouraging kids to become sex addicts. So this label of sex addiction is being grabbed onto by committed, upset people who want to go into your bedroom and control what kind of sex you get to have. I'm not okay with that, and I think lots of other people shouldn't be okay with it either. Secondly, I think that, you know, as I've said, I think this damages our view of men. I think that when we put out the message that your sexuality and male sexual desires are too powerful to control, I think it weakens, and I think it makes it harder for men to take responsibility. You know, one of the questions I asked people as I was writing the book was, you know, who are your sexual role models? When I asked women, you know, who their sexual role model was, what kind of, you know, the answers I would get would be people like Lady Gaga or even Madonna. These are powerful women who have taken their sexuality and made it a part of their life and who they are in a mostly a healthy way, where they were in control of it. When I asked men who their sexual role model was, most of them could not give me an answer, because when a man's sexuality becomes public, it is in a bad way. When a man's sexual behavior becomes news, he's in trouble for it.
Well, that's because having a healthy sexuality seems normal.
Former governor of New York, and you know, he got in trouble for prostitution. He got in trouble for cheating on his wife, and during the scandal, his advisors actually went to him and said, you know, Elliot, we think you need to come out and say you're a sex addict so that, you know, you can go into treatment and these problems will go away. And he said no. He said, you know, regardless of the mistakes I've made, I've always held people that work for me to the standard of being responsible for their behaviors. I can do no less. While I might disagree with, you know, his choices and his sexual behaviors, I've got to respect that choice. I've got to respect that ability to take control of your actions and take responsibility for them.
It's not just men's sexuality that society seeks to control, but I think it's pretty new that, you know, women's sexuality is just in a period where people are starting to be like, oh, women's sexuality has been controlled for the last 2,000 years, and it's beginning to start to open up. You know, so that's why I think that women's sexuality opening up is often newsworthy. But male sexuality hasn't been fettered in quite the same way, although I think that the examples that you're giving, the things about sex addiction being, you know, masturbation, porn use, cheating, you know, those are, I think a sex-positive person or a sex educator or, I mean, many people can give you very clear reasons why porn is actually okay and why masturbation is totally okay and why cheating isn't okay unless you have an agreement with your partner about it.
Because it's a relationship problem. Now, you know, it's interesting, and there's all this interesting social dynamics that go on. First, you know, I will note, you know, for hundreds of years, as women were called nymphomaniacs, you know, like even in the 1400s and 1500s, female sexuality and female masturbation was seen as the main way in which the devil gained access to a woman's soul.
Right.
And those women were burned at the stake. Women who were called nymphomaniacs even 100 years ago had lobotomies, they had their clitorises removed, they were put on horrific kinds of medication. Today, though, when a man is called a sex addict, he goes to a country club treatment program for a few weeks, spends
about $37,000
a day, cash on the barrel, and all of a sudden everything's okay. How does this compare?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sorry. I'm glad that we're not genitally mutilating men because of their sex addiction issue. But I do wish that women were getting the country club treatment.
What is going on here is that, you know, starting around 1980, our society went through a significant shift. And we started viewing men as inherently dangerous. We started viewing men as, you know, a danger to society. Men's feelings, men's sexuality, men's violence, men's aggression, all had to be controlled. And so all of a sudden, the ways in which men engaged sexually for thousands of years, like I said, infidelity, having multiple wives, etc., these were all things that were no longer acceptable. Now, here's a great example. Kennedy had more starlets in the White House bedrooms than probably any president or all presidents combined before and after him. Clinton had one blowjob in the White House and
he only had one.
Kennedy, the press knew about it and ignored it. So what changed? Well, two things changed. One, the media changed, and all of a sudden the media, the way the media makes money is by immediate gotcha journalism. They've got to have the news and the story fastest. Sex addiction and these sex scandals plays into that. But secondly, men engaging in that kind of behavior has become socially unacceptable. But what we haven't changed the way men are behaving. All we're changing now is A, the way in which it becomes news, and then B, we now have given them this excuse, this disease excuse that they get to say, oh, see, it's not my fault. It's not the fact that I made selfish, egotistical choices. I've got this sickness, and now I'm going to go to country club treatment program and get better.
Right, but there is a socially acceptable way to have multiple partners. I mean, it's, I guess, not socially acceptable outside of the Bay Area, you know, or New York City. But, you know, polyamory is a way that you could have in a relationship. I mean, even Newt Gingrich tried to have an open relationship. He just happened to be married to precisely the wrong people that wouldn't give it to him. Not that I would marry Newt Gingrich in a million years. But
I don't think I would marry Newt either. Ew. Open marriage or not. But, you know, I'll give you an alternative example, though. You know, a few years ago, Roy Romer was the governor of Colorado. And, you know, Mr. Romer had apparently had a female lover for many years, and the newspaper reporters found out about it. They set up a sting, and they basically caught him. He came out during a press conference, and he said, yes, I've had this partner for years. My wife knows about it. My family knows about it. I sat down with them, and we figured out how to make this work. He said, that's fidelity. He said he made agreements with his wife and his family, and he kept to them. And he made those agreements based upon who he was. He accepted that this was a person, this was part of who he was and what he needed to be. And he dealt with that in an honest, responsible manner. Instead, what we're telling men in these scandals and with the idea of sex addiction is you don't really have to know who you are. You don't have to really be in control of yourself. You just go out and do what you want. And then when you get caught, you just say that you're sick and it's not your fault.
Right. And you don't need to be honest with yourself and with your partner about what you really want, which is
That's
the
right.
most important thing in a relationship.
And you don't have to be honest with society either. And I think that's also, again, one of the dangers of this sex addiction concept is that we're taking high male libido and high female libido, too. One of the things I talk about in the myth of sex addiction is the women who do get called sex addicts tend to be women with high libido. They are women who sexually tend to act a little bit more like men. Mm-hmm. You know, are you know, maybe promiscuous, maybe bisexual, maybe, you know, having multiple relationships at once. They end up getting called sex addicts. You know, one of the authors of The Ethical Slut, I've got this great dialogue in the Myth of Sex Addiction where I actually talked to her, and she talked about how somebody called her a sex addict who had just happened to be able to engineer her life so that being a sex addict was okay. Which, again, remember that part of the definition of being a sex addict is that it causes problems in your life. But this, I think it was Janet Hardy. She said, you know, even though I had no problems in my life, just because I wanted sex more than this person thought I should
right,
and wasn't interested in being monogamous, Mm-hmm. That made me sex addict in their eyes.
Well, so let's talk about the history.
We're turning high libido into a disease. One of the other historical things that I talk about in the myth of sex addiction is that the idea of sex addiction really came up and became popular in the early 1980s, just around the same time that AIDS and HIV broke into the American public. And all of a sudden, you know, during the 70s, having sex and having lots of sex was accepted and fun, part of society, part of being free. In the 1980s, having too much sex, especially too much male sex, could kill you. All of a sudden, having too much sex or being too turned on became a disease.
Well, yeah, but I think this is something that I got from one of your articles, is that it's not suddenly. I mean, we've been a very sex-negative culture historically, all the way back to graham crackers and cornflakes. You know, the sanitariums, treating hysteria.
Both, you know, graham crackers and cornflakes were both invented because they thought that spicy foods made people too sexy. And that bland foods like cornflakes and graham crackers would keep people from masturbating. But one of the things I often point out is that, you know, they didn't anticipate s'mores. You know, when you add marshmallows and chocolate to graham crackers, I think it becomes pretty sexy.
Right, especially when you get it all over your fingers and you have to lick it off.
When you get it all over your fingers, your face, or anything else, yeah.
Right, right. Well, what happens when sex is viewed like it's a disease, like you can have too much sex and that will addict you to sex, or that sex is dangerous? What are the things that are taken away from us?
Well, for one thing, we're taking away the idea of individual variability. You know, again, one of the things Kinsey pointed out was that normal human sexuality is a curve. It's a normal curve, and the difference between one person and the next person on the curve is infinitesimal. There is no cliff. There's no drop off where all of a sudden people on one side of normal are having this amount of sex, and the people on the other side that are abnormal are having far more sex. It doesn't work like that. It is a normal curve, and there are people at the far end on both sides of the spectrum that either don't want to have any sex at all or want to have lots and lots of sex. We take away that ability for normal variation. Now, here's a good example. One of the things that they have tried to push for the idea of, for the definition of sex addiction, is that if you have sex or an orgasm once a day, every day, for about 3 months, then you're a sex addict. Well, I always point out that doesn't take into consideration multiple orgasms, because apparently if you have a very busy and productive night, you can ruin your average for the whole month.
Right.
But
secondly, scary.
There are lots of people out there, for instance, who masturbate and use orgasms as a sleep method. And in fact, that's very common among women.
Right.
So we're turning that into a disease.
Right.
The other thing is that there has been some research that shows that if they applied that rule, then all of a sudden as many as 40% of all men would be labeled as sex addicts at some point in their lives.
Something that I really like about your work is that you found that when people decide that, you know, sex isn't addictive, you know, that they're not sex addicts, that they really feel, you know, more empowered, and then there can be some really positive outcomes if you decide that it's not sex addiction that's causing your problems, but your choices.
Precisely. You know, I don't disagree that there are people out there who are struggling, and there are people who come into my office all the time and have problems in their lives, and sex is just one of the problems. Those folks are absolutely out there, and they absolutely need help. But sex is just a symptom. Sex is just a tip of the iceberg. When people are having sexual problems, 90 to 100% of them are having other kinds of problems as well. And when we over-focus on the sex, we are just responding from that puritanical kind of background where we say, okay, this person is having problems, and they're having lots of sex. It must be the sex's fault. The reality is there are other problems, and 70 to 100% of people that are allegedly diagnosed as sex addicts, they have some other major mental health condition, whether it's, you know, bipolar disorder, depression, substance abuse, real substance abuse, or a personality disorder, and these people have other problems where sex is just a part of it. But when we focus on sex addiction as being the problem, we're ignoring all of those other issues. You know, a therapist that I interviewed in the midst of sex addiction, he said it very well. He said sex addiction is a lazy diagnosis. If a therapist throws a sex addiction label at somebody, they're ignoring everything else. They heard sex, and they stopped there. Said sex is your problem.
Right. So your first book was called Insatiable Wives. What was that about?
That was a fascinating book. It actually kind of connects to this in an interesting way. The full title is Insatiable Wives, Women Who Stray and the Men Who Love Them. And it's actually about the history and practice of female infidelity, especially permissive female infidelity.
So, like consensual female infidelity. Like multiple.
Exactly. Consensual female infidelity. And I had couples who came in and they practiced what they called the hot wife and cuckold lifestyle. And these were women who were out there having sex with lots of other men.
Are you addicted to sex? Do you know someone who has too much sex? Can you have so much sex that suddenly a switch flips in your brain and suddenly you can't stop? What does sex addiction mean? We'll answer these questions and more with clinical psychologist Dr. David Lay, who treats perpetrators and victims of sexual abuse and has expanded his practice to include the full range of sexualities. This is a conversation about sex addiction on Sexploration with Monica.
This is sex. Everyone gets what they want. This is Sexploration.
Explore. Play.
This is Sexploration with Monica. Sex is proof that God loves us and wants us to have fun.
Sexploration with Monica.
At sexplorationwithmonica.com. Is it an addiction? Is it just bad choices? This has legal ramifications, and it also has some pretty interesting implications on how we think about cheating, for example, or sex crimes. Dr. David Lay is a clinical psychologist practicing in New Mexico. He first began his practice treating perpetrators and victims of sexual abuse and has expanded his practice to include the promotion of healthy sexuality and awareness of the wide range of normative sexual behaviors. We're going to be talking with him about sex addiction today, and he's written a book, The Myth of Sex Addiction. So you believe, Dr. Lay, that sex isn't an addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a long history of people calling sex a disease. I mean, a couple hundred years ago, women who liked sex too much were nymphomaniacs. Mm-hmm. Now, men who like sex too much are sex addicts. And really, this is just another form of people who are afraid of sex trying to control it and trying to prevent other people from having too much of it. To be honest, I'm not sure I want anybody in my bedroom telling me whether they like the sex I'm having or not, or whether I'm having too much.
So you think that because it's so subjective, like some people think a lot of sex is having sex once a day with your partner, and other people say lots of sex is having, you know, sex every day with a different sex worker. Because it's so subjective, you think that we should have different criteria for measuring what is healthy and unhealthy.
It is incredibly subjective. You know, Alfred Kinsey, the researcher, said that the definition of a nymphomaniac is somebody who has sex more than the therapist. That's what we have here. And even though people will argue that the criteria includes an element of what they call distress or dysfunction, in other words, they're saying, well, it's not just that you're having too much sex, but you're having too much sex and it's causing problems in your life. They like to say that, but the reality is they don't apply it. And in my book, I give lots and lots of examples of places where they are making the determination that sex is unhealthy or addictive, not because there are problems, but merely because they don't like the kind of sex you're having. It is incredibly subjective, and the example you gave actually is a pretty good one, because I've had people come in and tell me that they think that they are a sex addict, that they feel like their sexuality is just out of control. They feel like they're unable to stop themselves from masturbating or having sexual thoughts. And this one person that I'm thinking of was a young man who grew up in a very religious household. He was masturbating about once a week, and he believed that was out of control, and he came in saying, I think I'm a sex addict.
Oh.
Clearly he wasn't, and clearly that kind of sex was not causing problems in his life. The problem was in the conflict between his moral beliefs and the beliefs that he had been told about what kind of sexuality is appropriate and healthy versus his libido and his desire to have sex. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that moral beliefs and attitudes towards sex are that there's anything wrong with them. I think that there are. I think we have a lot of appropriate moral and religious beliefs about sex that are important for people, important for families, important for society. But they're not medicine. We shouldn't be basing diagnoses and treatment and research on those moral values.
Because there are some people who are making unhealthy choices in their sex life, choices that damage both themselves and their partners.
Sure. There are people that make unhealthy choices about everything in their life. One of the ones I'm particularly fond of these days is the degree to which people are making unhealthy choices in their life related to Facebook. I've seen marriages that have fallen apart over Facebook.
Crackbook.
Yeah, exactly. In my BlackBerry a couple of years ago, people were calling it CrackBerry.
Right.
Because it's hard to put the damn thing down. But it's non-addictive. It's not an addiction. It's not a disease. It's not out of our control. Sex is no more or less important than any of these other behaviors.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what addiction is and what it means. What is the definition of addiction in the psychological context?
Well, this is one of the places where it gets pretty muddy. And you have to understand that addiction right now, the word addiction, does not actually appear in what's called the DSM. The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. It's basically the Bible that lists out different kinds of mental disorders. The DSM currently talks about what's called substance abuse and substance dependence. The word addiction is, unfortunately, in our society, very broadly used at this point, and it is used to describe people who do things repetitively, even though it is causing problems in their life and they don't feel like they can stop. But unfortunately, we are now applying the word addiction to things like chapstick, things like tanning beds, things like Facebook, and the word addiction has stopped to mean something that is very valuable. One of the good examples that I give in my book, actually at the end of the book, is at the end of Myth of Sex Addiction, I talk about Harry Potter, and I was working with this young 9 or 10 year old little girl who came in and she said, "I think I'm addicted to Harry Potter," and I almost laughed my head off. But I didn't.
Yeah, I know how she feels though.
Yeah. Well, she was getting in trouble because she couldn't stop reading Harry Potter and she couldn't stop listening to the Harry Potter tapes, and she was getting in trouble because she was doing that stuff when she wasn't supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, for that little girl, Harry Potter was a friend. It was an escape. She was kind of lonely. She didn't have some friends around, and so it was a way for her to feel nurtured and not alone, kind of enjoy herself. And I worked with her. I worked with her to help find different things to do, worked with her parents on different things that she could do instead of the Harry Potter, find different ways to engage with it. And the problem went away. Now, interestingly enough, there's actually research by a psychologist where he showed that when the last Harry Potter book came out, certain Harry Potter fans actually went through what they called withdrawal syndrome.
Oh, totally.
Where they were cranky and obnoxious.
Oh, I was so sad.
Because now they didn't have it to read anymore.
It was awful. Yeah.
But it didn't last. And this little girl, after she made some changes in her life, I came back and I asked her, do you think you were addicted? And she said, well, yeah. And I said, well, why? She said, because it was hard to stop. But she did. And that's unfortunately the thing that we're doing now, is that we are pretending that just because something is hard to stop doing, that it's addictive and that it is a disease. But I think that's a dangerous message, because what we're doing is we're telling people that when something is really hard to stop doing, it means you're powerless over it.
Mm.
Sex is not like that. If we tell people that they're powerless over their sexual desires, we're creating a very dangerous message. And I'm concerned that potentially we're even telling people, well, just because you were aroused, it's not your fault that you committed that sex crime because you're addicted to sex. And in fact, that's one of the tragedies that I've seen that I talk about in the sex addiction, is that sex addiction is used extensively in court by people trying to avoid consequences for their behaviors, whether it is cheating and being divorced, or whether it is committing sex crimes like rape and child sex abuse. People are going in and saying, well, it's not my fault, I'm a sex addict. But it's not a real disease, it's not an accepted diagnosis, and it doesn't meet criteria for acceptable evidence in a court of law. But people are using it as a get-out-of-jail-card-free.
Right. So not only is it disempowering because we believe that sex, we are powerless over our impulses, but also it's allowing people to get away with making hurtful choices and hurting other people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the fascinating things, and you know, as my book has gotten out there and I'm getting, you know, emails and contacts from people, I've heard from both men and women who've been damaged by the label of sex addiction. One man wrote me the other day, and he talked about the fact that, you know, his wife dragged him to a therapist, and the therapist called him a sex addict because the guy liked to look at porn every now and then, about once a week, and his wife just really didn't like it and thought that porn was just absolutely unacceptable. The wife and the therapist called him a sex addict. Another woman wrote me, and she said that, you know, her husband went to told her that she couldn't divorce him because her husband was a sex addict. It wasn't his fault that he was cheating, and that if she did divorce him, her husband would probably kill himself.
Did he say that he was going to kill himself?
It's not helpful.
Right.
And in fact, it's dangerous, and I see it doing lots of harm. One of the big kind of places that I see as dangerous is the way in which this label is applied to male sexuality. 85% to 90% of the people diagnosed as sex addicts are men, and the majority of the behaviors that are called sexually addictive are male sexual behaviors. These include things like masturbation, use of pornography, going to strip clubs, infidelity, use of prostitutes. These are all behaviors that are overwhelmingly predominantly masculine. And so what we're doing is we're turning male sexuality into a disease.
Well, I would hate to say that any of those things are excluded from women being able to choose to do them in a healthy or unhealthy way, of course.
But
it truly is less predominant among women, yes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, women don't go to prostitutes.
Sometimes they do, not too frequently. I mean, I talk to sex workers who see women. Of course, most of their clients are men, but I do know some sex workers who have female clients. It's rare. You're right.
It is rare because women may not have to go to prostitutes, or when women do, they keep it much quieter. Whereas roughly 16% of American men will, on average, go to a prostitute at least once in their life. Regardless of whether they go, nearly half of all American men believe prostitution is acceptable. The numbers are far smaller for women. But what we're doing when we apply the label of sex addict to men is that we're saying, unless a man engages in normal, acceptable kinds of sexual behavior that don't include masturbation, that don't include pornography, don't include strippers, don't include cheating, that they are unhealthy. But the reality is that, you know, throughout history, men have engaged in those behaviors. You know, David and Solomon in the Bible had hundreds of thousands of wives. And even David in the Bible, the hundreds of wives he had wasn't enough, and he still wanted somebody else's wife.
Well, I think that there's the ability we have now to make distinctions like which behaviors are healthy, which behaviors are consensual, which behaviors are having a good impact on yourself and the people in your life, so that I think it's actually important to make a distinction between porn and, for instance, cheating. Of course, that's my opinion.
I agree. I think that, unfortunately, the challenge is who gets to decide what's healthy and who gets to decide what's appropriate. And so right now what we have is if somebody else doesn't like your sexual behavior, then it gets called addictive. It gets called unhealthy. One of the number one reasons why men enter sex addiction treatment is because they want sex more than their wife does. And whenever anybody in a couple wants sex more than the other one does, they almost invariably end up getting called a sex addict. not a disease.
Can we talk a little bit about the kinds of addiction that do end up being more like disease, like alcohol and drug addiction, and the difference between what people are calling sex addiction and then alcohol addiction, for example?
The number one difference is that, you know, with alcohol, with drugs, these are ingesting different substances into the body and into the brain that actually change the way the brain or the body is working. When somebody consumes alcohol, it is affecting their entire body. When somebody is aroused, they may be very aroused, but their brain is still working the way it is supposed to. There are no neurochemicals in the brain that aren't supposed to be there. There are no chemicals in the body that aren't supposed to be there.
So dopamine and oxytocin.
Nobody died from wanting to have sex and not getting to have it.
But people do die.
If you take a hardcore alcoholic and mm-hmm. take away alcohol, make them go cold turkey, they can actually die because their body has become physiologically dependent upon the presence of that substance.
Right. Now, what are the dangers to society in believing that there is such a thing as a diagnosis of sex addiction?
It's a good question. I think actually there are several. Now, one of the things I have to kind of say is when I went into writing this book, I really had to ask myself, you know, is this important? Does it really matter if people are out there getting help, you know, by calling themselves sex addicts? Does it matter? Ultimately, I decided that it does matter, and here are some of the reasons why. One is that I think that this is a way for a certain moral and morally motivated group to put restrictions on the other people's sexuality. Now, a great example crossed my desk the other day. I wish this had come out before I wrote the book. There's a religious group out there who is attacking Planned Parenthood and saying that Planned Parenthood is teaching kids to be sex addicts. And that by promoting sexually appropriate behaviors like kissing, that is encouraging kids to become sex addicts. So this label of sex addiction is being grabbed onto by committed, upset people who want to go into your bedroom and control what kind of sex you get to have. I'm not okay with that, and I think lots of other people shouldn't be okay with it either. Secondly, I think that, you know, as I've said, I think this damages our view of men. I think that when we put out the message that your sexuality and male sexual desires are too powerful to control, I think it weakens. And I think it makes it harder for men to take responsibility. You know, one of the questions I asked people as I was writing the book was, you know, who are your sexual role models? When I asked women, you know, who their sexual role model was, what kind of, you know, the answers I would get would be people like Lady Gaga or even Madonna. These are powerful women who have taken their sexuality and made it a part of their life and who they are in a mostly a healthy way, where they were in control of it. When I asked men who their sexual role model was, most of them could not give me an answer, because when a man's sexuality becomes public, it is in a bad way. When a man's sexual behavior becomes news, he's in trouble for it.
Well, that's because having a healthy sexuality seems normal.
When I looked at Elliot Spitzer, the former governor of New York, and, you know, he got in trouble for prostitution, he got in trouble for cheating on his wife, and during the scandal, his advisors actually went to him and said, you know, Elliot, we think you need to come out and say you're a sex addict so that, you know, you can go into treatment and these problems will go away. And he said no. He said, you know, regardless of the mistakes I've made, I've always held people that work for me to the standard of being responsible for their behaviors. I can do no less. While I might disagree with, you know, his choices and his sexual behaviors, I've got to respect that choice. I've got to respect that ability to take control of your actions and take responsibility for them.
It's not just men's sexuality that society seeks to control, but I think it's pretty new that, you know, women's sexuality is just in a period where people are starting to be like, oh, women's sexuality has been controlled for the last 2,000 years, and it's beginning to start to open up. You know, so that's why I think that women's sexuality opening up is often newsworthy. But male sexuality hasn't been fettered in quite the same way. Although I think that the examples that you're giving, the things about sex addiction being, you know, masturbation, porn use, cheating, you know, those are, I mean, I think a a sex positive person or a sex educator, or I mean, many people can give you very clear reasons why porn is actually okay and why masturbation is totally okay and why cheating isn't okay unless you have an agreement with your partner about it.
Because it's a relationship problem. Now, you know, it's interesting, and there's all this interesting social dynamics that go on. First, you know, I will note, you know, for hundreds of years, as women were called nymphomaniacs, you know, like even in the 14 and 1500s, female sexuality and female masturbation was seen as the main way in which the devil gained access to a woman's soul.
Right.
And those women were burned at the stake. Women who were called nymphomaniacs even 100 years ago had lobotomies, they had their clitorises removed, they were put on horrific kinds of medication. Today, though, when a man is called a sex addict, he goes to a country club treatment program for a few weeks,
spends for $37,000
a day, mm-hmm. cash on the barrel, and all of a sudden everything's okay. How does this compare?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sorry. I'm glad that we're not genitally mutilating men because of their sex addiction issue. But I do wish that women were getting the country club treatment.
One of the things that I think is going on here is that, you know, starting around 1980, our society went through a significant shift. And we started viewing men as inherently dangerous. We started viewing men as, you know, a danger to society. Men's feelings, men's sexuality, men's violence, men's aggression, all had to be controlled. And so all of a sudden, the ways in which men engaged sexually for thousands of years, like I said, infidelity, having multiple wives, etc., these were all things that were no longer acceptable. Now, here's a great example. Kennedy had more starlets in the White House bedrooms than probably any president or all presidents combined before and after him. Clinton had one blowjob in the White House
and was almost impeached. Only had one.
Kennedy, the press knew about it and ignored it. So what changed? Well, two things changed. One, the media changed, and all of a sudden the media, the way the media makes money is by immediate gotcha journalism. They've got to have the news and the story fastest. Sex addiction and these sex scandals plays into that. But secondly, men engaging in that kind of behavior has become socially unacceptable. But what we haven't changed the way men are behaving. All we're changing now is A, the way in which it becomes news, and then B, we now have given them this excuse, this disease excuse that they get to say, oh, see, it's not my fault. It's not the fact that I made selfish, egotistical choices. I've got this sickness, and now I'm going to go to country club treatment program and get better.
Right, but there is a socially acceptable way to have multiple partners. I mean, it's, I guess, not socially acceptable outside of the Bay Area, you know, or New York City. But, you know, polyamory is a way that you could have in a relationship. I mean, even Newt Gingrich tried to have an open relationship. He just happened to be married to precisely the wrong people that wouldn't give it to him. Not that I would marry Newt Gingrich in a million years, but
I don't think I would marry Newt either. Open marriage or not, but you know, I'll give you an alternative example though. You know, a few years ago, Roy Romer was the governor of Colorado, and you know, Mr. Romer had apparently had a female lover for many years, and the newspaper reporters found out about it. They set up a sting and they basically caught him. He came out during a press conference and he said, yes, I've had this partner for years. My wife knows about it. My family knows about it. I sat down with them and we figured out how to make this work. He said, that's fidelity. He said he made agreements with his wife and his family and he kept to them. And he made those agreements based upon who he was. He accepted that this was a person, that this was part of who he was and what he needed to be. And he dealt with that in an honest, responsible manner. Instead, what we're telling men in these scandals and with the idea of sex addiction is you don't really have to know who you are. You don't have to really be in control of yourself. You just go out and do what you want. And then when you get caught, you just say that you're sick and it's not your fault.
Right. And you don't need to be honest with yourself and with your partner about what you really want, which is
That's
the
right.
most important thing in a relationship.
And you don't have to be honest with society either. And I think that's also, again, one of the dangers of this sex addiction concept, is that we're taking high male libido and high female libido, too. One of the things I talk about in the myth of sex addiction is the women who do get called sex addicts tend to be women with high libido. They are women who sexually tend to act a little bit more like men. Mm-hmm. You know, are you know, maybe promiscuous, maybe bisexual, maybe, you know, having multiple relationships at once. They end up getting called sex addicts. You know, one of the authors of The Ethical Slut, I've got this great dialogue in The Myth of Sex Addiction where I actually talked to her, and she talked about how somebody called her a sex addict who had just happened to be able to engineer her life so that being a sex addict was okay. Which, again, remember that part of the definition of being a sex addict is that it causes problems in your life. But this, I think it was Janet Hardy. She said, you know, even though I had no problems in my life, just because I wanted sex more than this person thought I should,
right,
and
relative,
wasn't interested in being monogamous, mm-hmm, that made me a sex addict.
Right. Well, so let's talk about the history.
We're turning high libido into a disease. One of the other historical things that I talk about in the myth of sex addiction is that the idea of sex addiction really came up and became popular in the early 1980s, just around the same time that AIDS and HIV broke into the American public. And all of a sudden, you know, during the 70s, having sex and having lots of sex was accepted and fun, part of society, part of being free. In the 1980s, having too much sex, especially too much male sex, could kill you. All of a sudden, having too much sex or being too turned on became a disease.
Well, yeah, but I think this is something that I got from one of your articles, is that it's not suddenly. I mean, we've been a very sex-negative culture historically, all the way back to graham crackers and cornflakes,
mm-hmm,
you know, the sanitariums, treating hysteria.
Both, you know, graham crackers and cornflakes were both invented because they thought that spicy food made people too sexy. Mm-hmm. And that bland foods like cornflakes and graham crackers would keep people from masturbating. But one of the things I often point out is that, you know, they didn't anticipate s'mores. You know, when you add marshmallows and chocolate to graham crackers, I think it becomes pretty sexy.
Right, especially when you get it all over your fingers and you have to lick it off.
When you get it all over your fingers, your face, or anything else, yeah.
Right. Well, what happens when sex is viewed like it's a disease, like you can have too much sex and that will addict you to sex, or that sex is dangerous? What are the things that are taken away from us?
Well, for one thing, we're taking away the idea of individual variability. You know, again, one of the things Kinsey pointed out was that normal human sexuality is a curve. It's a normal curve, and the difference between one person and the next person on the curve is infinitesimal. There is no cliff. There's no drop off where all of a sudden people on one side of normal are having this amount of sex, and the people on the other side that are abnormal are having far more sex. It doesn't work like that. It is a normal curve, and there are people at the far end on both sides of the spectrum that either don't want to have any sex at all or want to have lots and lots of sex. We take away that ability for normal variation. Now, here's a good example. One of the things that they have tried to push for the definition of sex addiction is that if you have sex or an orgasm once a day, every day, for about 3 months, then you're a sex addict. Well, I always point out that doesn't take into consideration multiple orgasms, because apparently if you have a very busy and productive night, you can ruin your average for a month.
Right.
But
secondly,
there are lots of people out there, for instance, who masturbate and use orgasms as a sleep method. And in fact, that's very common among women.
Right.
So we're turning that into a disease.
Right.
The other thing is that there has been some research that shows that if they applied that rule, then all of a sudden as many as 40% of all men would be labeled as sex addicts at some point in their lives.
Something that I really like about your work is that you found that when people decide that, you know, sex isn't addictive, you know, that they're not sex addicts, that they really feel, you know, more empowered, and then there can be some really positive outcomes if you decide that it's not sex addiction that's causing your problems, but your choices?
Precisely. You know, I don't disagree that there are people out there who are struggling, and there are people who come into my office all the time and have problems in their lives, and sex is just one of the problems. Those folks are absolutely out there, and they absolutely need help. But sex is just a symptom. Sex is just a tip of the iceberg. When people are having sexual problems, 90 to 100% of them are having other kinds of problems as well. And when we over-focus on the sex, we are just responding from that puritanical kind of background where we say, okay, this person is having problems and they're having lots of sex. It must be the sex's fault. The reality is there are other problems. And 70 to 100% of people that are allegedly diagnosed as sex addicts, they have some other major mental health condition, whether it's, you know, bipolar disorder, depression, substance abuse, real substance abuse, or a personality disorder. And these people have other problems where sex is just a part of it. But when we focus on sex addiction as being the problem, we're ignoring all of those other issues. You know, a therapist that I interviewed in the midst of sex addiction, he said it very well. He said sex addiction is a lazy diagnosis. If a therapist throws a sex addiction label at somebody, they're ignoring everything else. They heard sex, and they stopped there. Said sex is your problem.
Right. So your first book was called Insatiable Wives. What was that about?
You know, that was a fascinating book. It actually kind of connects to this in an interesting way. The full title is Insatiable Wives, Women Who Stray and the Men Who Love Them. And it's actually about the history and practice of female infidelity, especially permissive female infidelity.
So, like consensual, you know, female infidelity. Like multiple.
Exactly. Consensual female infidelity. I had couples who came in and they practiced what they called the hot wife and cuckold lifestyle. And these were women who were out there having sex with lots of other men, with their husband's permission, encouragement, support. I will be absolutely honest. When these couples, when I first met these couples, I thought, wow, that can't be healthy. Because I had been programmed by our society to believe that that just wasn't acceptable. But these couples I saw had been married for 30 years, and they had incredibly healthy marriages. They had some of the best communication skills I've ever seen.
Yeah, you get that when you start getting multiple partners going.
Yeah, you know, what they told me was, you know, if you can talk about this stuff, you can talk about everything.
Yeah.
So I spent, you know, I thought it was fascinating. When I looked, there was absolutely nothing written about it. So I spent some time interviewing couples around the country that do this for about a year and a half, and researched everything I could find about it, and wrote a book that was kind of fun. But in the book, one of the stories I told was about a man who really was obsessed with the idea of sharing his wife, or, you know, his various wives, because he'd been married multiple times, with black men. And he just really was obsessed about this. He just had a huge fantasy about it. And so much so that, you know, his marriages had broken up. But when I saw him, he was pretty much happy with it. It was not a problem for him. And I said in the book, as I told his story, I said, you know, it'd be real easy to call this guy a sex addict, but I don't believe in sex addiction. That one little statement, that one little story actually led to this book, because people kept challenging me on that. And I said, well, you know, sex addiction is not real. But it turns out in the media, if you watch CNN even, they talk about sex addiction as though it's real.
Oh, Tiger Woods, David Duchovny, all the
time. In general clinical practice and in science, sex addiction is viewed as not substantiated. It's not evidence-based. There's no research to support it. Most scientists and doctors don't believe in it. But the media tells us to believe in it. Why? And I thought that was a really interesting part of the myth of sex addiction that I explored, that I talked about, which is that the media makes lots and lots of money off the idea of sex addiction, because they've got these reality shows. They also have the ability to make you afraid of sex by putting up this story about this celebrity or that celebrity and saying, you know, ooh, they're in trouble. They destroyed their life because of sex.
Right.
They must be a sex addict. And guess what? Your husband or your boyfriend or your wife, they might be a sex addict too. You better tune in at 10 to find out.
Right. The emotional
hooks.
They
create this fear, and the media feeds off of it. And it feeds off our general fear of sex, because our society is afraid of sex. We're titillated by it, but we're terrified of it.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time for this interview, but Dr. David Lay, thank you so much for coming on the program. You can find him, both his books, Insatiable Wives and The Myth of Sex Addiction. What's your website?
You know, the easiest way for folks to find me is on Psychology Today. And you can just Google me. It's David Lay. Last name is L-E-Y, even though it sounds like Lay, L-A-Y, which is funny given that I'm writing about
that. Yeah, totally. Well, Dr. David Lay, thank you so much for coming on Sexploration with Monica.
Thanks, Monica. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
You can subscribe to Sexploration with Monica on iTunes and have new episodes delivered automatically. Or download free podcasts at sexplorationwithmonica.com.